Did you know that parents rank financial literacy as the number one most difficult life skill to teach? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app for families. With Greenlight, you send instant money transfers, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on your kids' spending. With real-time notifications, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. And parents can rest easy, knowing their kids are learning about money with guardrails in place. Get your first month free at greenlight.com/odyssey.
Finally, Gil Hodges, the manager of the 69 Miracle Mets, among many other things in his brilliant career, into the Hall of Fame. No idea how it took this long, but Gil is in, and we have a fun little podcast centered around that, and a Mets minor leaguer that you've probably never heard of. How do we tie those two seemingly random things together and come up with a high-quality program? We have our ways. Connecting Hodges and Holderman, and not just alphabetically. We'll clue you in on how we're going to do this in 26 seconds.
Mets in the morning. Mets in the morning. Oh, yeah. Mets in the morning. Gonna tell you what the Mets are doing. While coffee is brewing now. Here's Josh Lewin.
Connecting two seemingly unrelated items or players or human beings in general is always a fun assignment. And by God, I think I've done it. This episode was originally going to be just a lot of talk about the guys in the Arizona Fall League if Gil Hodges didn't get in. But thank the Lord he did get in, along with Buck O'Neill, Manny Manoso, Jim Cott, and Tony Oliva, all of them quite deserving. Josh Lewin with you. We also wanted to introduce you to the tall, strong, righty reliever out of Bourbonnais, Illinois, Mr. Colin Holderman. So how do we do this? And who goes first, Hodges or Holderman? Well, before I hit the record button, I did what any right-minded person would do when faced with such a conundrum. I flipped a coin. Heads Hodges, tails Holderman. And whoever said tails never fails just likes to rhyme things, because there is no scientific basis in Tails Never Fails. We will rightfully lead with Gil Hodges. And as for the tie-in, it's not that they both begin with H. That would have been a layup. I went with geography. Got this idea from the Orioles back in the mid-90s when they figured out that Cal Ripken was born in Aberdeen, Maryland, where the Susquehanna River begins. It flows up through Montoursville, Pennsylvania, where Orioles great Mike Mussina is from. It ends an eighth of a mile, believe it or not, from Cooperstown, New York, where the Hall of Fame, of course, is located. And the popular movie, when the Orioles PR staff figured all that out, a river runs through it. Boom. There's your hook. You follow Cal Ripken, stop off at Mike Mussina, dump them both out in the Hall of Fame if you just wander up the Susquehanna. So in this case, I don't rightfully know if Colin Holderman is headed to Cooperstown someday. Highest level he's pitched at so far is AA. But here's the fun Rand McNally-inspired thread. Gil Hodges was born and raised in Princeton, Indiana, which is right on the Indiana-Illinois state line. If you follow State Highway 150 north a couple hundred miles, you'll never guess where you end up. Just a handful of stoplights away from Bourbonnais, Illinois, hometown of Colin Holderman. So let's take a little road trip here. You and me, that's our theme. I think Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie was way out west, but for our purposes, Travels with Joshy, hop into my back seat and let's drive the Hoosier State of Indiana. And we will start in Princeton as I fire up the only song about Indiana I really remember. It's by the a cappella group Rockapella. Came out back around the time the Mets won the 86 World Series. This was a few years after the movie Cutters had come out. And if you're of a certain age, that's what you know about Indiana. Not the Indy 500, not that Larry Bird is from French Lick, not that Bobby Knight threw a chair at Assembly Hall. The movie that inspired me when I was coming of age growing up, and I was nowhere near Indiana, was Cutters. Or actually, Breaking Away. That was the real name of the movie, about the Cutters. Everything Daniel Stern did in that movie, chase the girl, chase the dream, ride a 10-speed racing bike, learn a little Italian, swim in a rock quarry, try to get out of your hometown and see the world, I was looking at all that stuff. I looked like the Jackie Earl Haley character, but I aspired to be the Daniel Stern character. And I can still speak a little Italian. Molto bene. Andiamo. Buca di Beppo. Anyway, Gil Hodges' hometown and Colin Holderman's hometowns, yes, are on that SR 150 that actually starts down south of Louisville, Kentucky, where they made Gil Hodges' bats back in the day. But if you keep going through Kentucky, you end up in Princeton. Home to not only Gil Hodges, but for what it's worth, Hall of Fame voice of the Seattle Mariners, Dave Niehaus. May he rest in peace. And Marlins scouting director Gary Denbo is from there. He came up in the Yankees coaching and managing ranks with Buck Showalter. We'll put a pin in that one and see if we come back down the road. Up the road, keep going on 150, straddling that Indiana-Illinois state line. You get to Vincennes, which housed the first ever Cal Ripken League World Series about 20 years ago and was the original home of legendary Shea Stadium organist Jane Jarvis. This is just working out so great. Up a little further, past all the Dairy Queens and Red Barns and everything you'd find in a song by John Cougar Mellencamp, Terre Haute, home to the Indiana State Sycamores, where, yes, Larry Bird attended college and grew that weird little mustache. But Terre Haute is home to the legendary Scatman Crothers, who you may remember from the TV show Chico and the Man, which was the partner program of Sanford and Son on NBC while Jane Jarvis was in her Shea Stadium groove. And you may remember Sanford and Son as the walk-up music for Mets favorite and recent celebrator of a birthday, one Cliff Floyd. Did I make that one work? Is that a stretch? That was Keith Hernandez going for a throw in the dirt from Rafael Santana, stretch-wise. But I'm giving myself the bingo. I'm saying I got it. By the way, if you Google Terre Haute, Indiana, as I did, the first thing that suggested that comes up on Google is the question, why does Terre Haute smell? And there's an answer for this. Built in 1962, there was a sewage treatment plant that utilized technology that sent a rotten egg smell, hydrogen sulfide, into the air from the points where sewage entered the system and was stored for processing. Adding to that problem, a paper mill and a creosote plant operated for many years nearby, giving off their own undesirable odors. Anyway, eventually, along that Wabash River, heading north from Princeton, Indiana, which does not smell, I don't think, you get to Bourbonnais, Illinois, and we'll get to that a little later on. We got to get back to Gil Hodges. He belonged in the Hall of Fame a very long time ago, and if you need credentials, well, we have them for you. He was one of only two players with 300 or more home runs and 1,000 or more RBIs in the 1950s. The other was Duke Snider. I think dominating a decade in power numbers should probably guarantee you admission to the Hall of Fame. That's just my thought, I guess, but I don't know. I was just always stuck on the fact that Harold Baines was elected by this committee, the Golden Era Committee, basically 3 years ago. And, I mean, Harold Baines had 384 home runs. Gil Hodges had 370, but played, obviously, in a very different time and for many fewer years. Gil was an 8-time All-Star. Harold Baines was a 6-time All-Star. Don't get me started on the defense. I'm going to get there in just a moment. But all that is, as a player, what we're talking about with Gil Hodges for now. As Mets manager, he took a 100-1 underdog, literally. Got him not only into the World Series, but had him win the thing in 5 games against a Baltimore team that was brimming with talent, from the insane starting pitching to Brooks and Frank Robinson, Boog Powell, all the rest. Just like New York was an underdog in 69 to Baltimore in football, and Joe Namath, long before the Medicare ads guaranteed victory for the upstart Jets, Joe Namath led them to the big upset. Gil Hodges, who had nothing in common with Joe Namath, did the exact same thing regarding baseball that very same year. So give him his managerial props, and just back to the defense, it was phenomenal. Had there been gold gloves throughout the entire 1950s, he'd have swept them. As it stands, all he did was won the three that he could have won. But as our friend over on the Yankees beat, Sweeney Murdy, has pointed out, for all the talking we do about the importance of defense at first base, the only multiple gold glove winner at first already in the Hall is Eddie Murray. Keith Hernandez won 11 of those bad boys, Don Mattingly 9. No Love, no Sale, no Cooperstown. That's very weird to me. But anyway, some more playing highlights if you need them. Obviously, he was with the Mets in their original incarnation in 62. He hit the team's first ever home run. Then he went away to start the managerial thing. Went off to manage the Washington Senators. Came back to manage the Mets in 68. We've talked about the Miracle Mets in 69. He died way too young at age 48 on the golf course during the April player strike of 1972. But as a manager in 69, he was in charge of a heck of a pitching staff. He maneuvered it beautifully. But what a job he did in restoring the confidence of Tommy Agee. This doesn't get talked about a lot. I'm sure Howie and Gary and those guys would talk about it a lot. But I have the microphone currently. Howie's going to join in just a moment. Tommy Agee had been American League Rookie of the Year in 66 with the White Sox, came over with Al Weiss for Tommy Davis in 68, and he was considered to be a poor man's Willie Mays, leading to the awesome nickname of the Shea-Hay Kid. But his first year as a Met, he was hitting 168 at the beginning of August. He ended up at 217, five home runs. First pitch of spring training that year, he had taken a fastball off the helmet from Bob Gibson. Somehow Gil Hodges takes that wavering confidence of Tommy Agee, gets it righted, and in 69, 26 homers, 76 runs batted in, Tour de Force Game 3 of that World Series, had the home run and those two memorable diving catches, one with two on, one with the bases loaded. So some of the other players that have weighed in over the years, remember J.C. Martin, the catcher traded to the Cubs after 69. He later said if Gil Hodges had managed the Cubs, he would have won there, because a manager does make a difference. With Gil, you got the feeling just do whatever he says and don't panic. He says, I played for Leo Durocher. Leo Durocher caused panic and confusion. So to review, Gil Hodges, six pennants. He won the first three gold gloves that were available. He held the title of most home runs by a righty, led the Mets to a World Series, all of that before the age of 47, when he died that Easter Sunday of 1972. Joe Torre's mom, the Brooklyn native, was once asked on the Today Show who her favorite player was. Everyone expected her to say either Joe or his brother Frank. Margaret Torre said, without batting an eyelash, Gil Hodges. So, look, as a player, the numbers spoke for themselves. As a manager, he was lionized. As a citizen of the country and the planet, he was as rock solid as they come. Everyone, I think, just assumed he was in the Hall of Fame. He was not until this past weekend. So finally, a grave injustice has been fixed. Even Vin Scully weighed in on that. Vin Scully, who, of course, knew him so well from the Dodger days, put out a great line pretty recently that said, before I leave this mortal coil, I want to see and know that Gil Hodges made the Hall of Fame. So there you go, Vin. All is good. And as for the emotional reasoning behind Gil's inclusion in Cooperstown, I went right to the rabbi for this one. Who better to be asked the question during the Festival of Lights, no less, than our own Howie Rose, keeper of the Hodges flame for lo these many years. And I asked a simple question of my former radio partner and future member of Cooperstown, Howie, why was this always so important to you that Gil finally got in, and what should all Mets fans know about his legacy?
You know, it's pretty interesting. I never even met Gil Hodges, and yet when word came down that he'd finally been elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame, I was about as happy as I was when Gil's Mets won the 1969 World Series. I have unabashedly said for years that Gil Hodges has been my favorite Met ever. Now, that goes back to day one of the franchise, and I say that because as a kid who was 8 years old in 1962 when the Mets played their first game in the National League, I knew of Gil Hodges. I knew the name from my dad asking questions and really surmising that he had been a pretty big deal in New York at one time. So that immediately drew me to Gil among all of those on this new ball club, the Mets. So the first game I ever went to at the Polo Grounds that the Mets played in 1962, Gil hit a home run. In fact, it would prove to be the last home run that he ever hit in the major leagues. And it also surpassed Ralph Kiner, of all people, on the all-time National League right-handed hitters home run list. That's right. He actually was the all-time National League right-handed home run hitter at one point until being passed by Willie Mays and others years later. But what Gil meant to the Mets when he came there as the manager in 1968 was almost impossible to describe if you weren't around back then to understand what the Mets had been. They were an expansion team in 1962 that basically had been a joke, and they lost in innumerable ways and almost hard to calculate amount of games from 1962 through 1967. Then Gil got there in 1968, and all of a sudden, everything was serious, and you could tell that there was a different look. You could tell there was a different texture to that Mets team from that first spring training in 68, because Gil quite simply meant business, and you could just see as a fan that this was a different looking Mets team than they'd ever been. And they still only won 73 games that first year in 68. We all know what happened in 69 when they won 100 games and won it all. And in listening to some of his former players speak over the years, players, they're convinced that they would not have won if not for what Gil Hodges meant to them as people and as players. His character was beyond reproach. There's always been a specific paragraph among the list of qualifications for candidacy to the Baseball Hall of Fame that addresses character. And if people thought among the voters that Gil's numbers might have been a little thin, borderline on the wrong side of election for many years, his character, the totality of the man, and certainly his accomplishments, both as a player and a manager, which are now allowed to be considered, put him over the top. So I personally am just elated that Gil has made the Hall of Fame. It rights what, at least to me, has been a long time wrong. And for Joan Hodges, who's 95 years young, Gil Jr. and the rest of the Hodges family, I could not be any more thrilled than I am with the news that Gil is finally getting his rightful place in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Thanks so much to the velvet-voiced, historically perfect Howie Rose. So yes, that, boys and girls, is why we're also overjoyed that Gil Hodges is now not only in the Mets Hall of Fame, but in the Baseball Hall of Fame. All right, we will shift to the minor leaguer we've been threatening to tell you about. Let's go. All right, we are talking Colin Holderman, 6'7", 240 pounds, and he hit up to 99 miles an hour and got multiple swings and misses on his high spin rate slider this past year. Ninth round 2016, Heartland Community College, and before that, Southern Illinois, where he was 2-3 with a 7.68 ERA. But the height and the stuff, and not for nothing, ninth round, 280th pick overall. You know who was ninth round, 272nd pick overall? Jacob DeGrom, whose uniform number in college, by the way, was 5. Did you know that? Jacob DeGrom in college had David Wright's uniform number, a portent of the greatness to come. Anyway, Holderman back in 2017 debuted at full season A-ball with 6 shutout innings, 11 strikeouts in Columbia. But he would make just 3 more starts. He had a small labrum tear in his shoulder. He was limited to just a few more starts after that. Tommy John would knock him out for all of 2018, and all that prospect hype was largely forgotten. But he's made his recovery. He's made his way back. This past year, 3.86 ERA at Single-A St. Lucie, 3.26 at Double-A Binghamton, designs on Triple-A Syracuse this spring. Here's our conversation with him from when the Arizona Fall League was just getting going. All right, we got a big pitcher to introduce to you here. Colin Holderman says he's 6'7", maybe on his toes 6'7". I'm going to hold with 6'7". He looks the part. Went from 240 down to, I guess, the mid-220s. Was that a conscious effort on your part, I imagine?
Yes. Been spending a good amount of time in the gym in the off seasons and really wanted to dial the weight in to about 225, 230. That's where my body kind of performs best. And I've definitely seen the results from that, especially this year. When I was healthy, the fastball velo has been up. The stuff's been better. So I think staying around 225, 230 would be the plan for the rest of my career.
So just to clue people in, this is one of the many with Tommy John surgery on the resume. And if you wouldn't mind, because, you know, we talk about it as broadcasters as just kind of this shrug, like, oh, yeah, the guy had Tommy John. Then we don't say anything else about it. So where were you when you found out that this was happening? And did you panic, or how did that all go in your head?
Well, it was in spring training in 2018. It was one of the last games of the before he broke camp, and I just threw a ball, heard a pop. It was nowhere near the home plate. It went somewhere I didn't really remember, but I knew instantly the second I released it what happened.
Wow.
So we got an MRI, I think, the next day, and in my head I already knew what was going to happen. And I was already moved on. I was like, all right, it's time to get the surgery. How's the recovery going to look? Start to set up a plan. I wasn't really too mad or sad. It was kind of a thing that it's probably going to happen at some point, so I wasn't too mad about it. But it was definitely the best thing I think that's happened for my career. And ever since then, I've been pretty healthy, and my stuff's gotten better, and body's gotten better, and I can't complain.
When you go in for that surgery, again, because it's just always been on my mind, like, well, I've never had one, but it seems like everybody in baseball has. What's the process? I mean, is it just like any other surgery that I would imagine? Or, I mean, are they telling you, okay, here's what we're going to do with the anesthesia, here's how long it takes to recover? I mean, what's that whole process like?
It was pretty normal. Dr. Olchek did a great job. He was a super professional. He came in, just told me what was going to happen. He's like, yep, your UCL is completely torn. It's like almost in your bicep.
Wow.
So it's a pretty they don't cut dry, we're just going to fix it. It's going to take about a year to get back into games. And then you're not going to feel really good until about 18 to 20 months. And that's exactly how it was for me. I was kind of worried around the year mark. My fastball velo wasn't back yet. But I just stayed true to the process. And around that 18 to 20 months mark, that's when I felt great, felt back to normal. The fastball started coming back and feel for all my pitches. And that's why I tell all the younger guys that are getting in now, you just have to wait for that 18 to 20 month mark, and it'll come back. Yes, yeah. Just don't get too frustrated at that year mark. It'll take some more time.
So, what did you do just to kind of buy some time? I mean, that's a long time. Oh, yeah. I mean, the months must have felt like years while mm-hmm. you're waiting for that to come back.
Yep, I was actually fortunate enough. They let me go home for the first 5 months and do my rehab in Chicago with Bracy Performance and Katie Sandberg as my physical therapist. It was great. They mm-hmm. were the best. The gym, we were getting after it every day. And then afterwards, I'd go to physical therapy, and they whipped my butt. They got me in shape, and then we were ready to go by the time I came back to Port St. Lucie to start throwing again, and I was in the best shape of my life.
That's awesome. Now, for those that don't know, Colin was a ninth-round pick. We got to go back to 2016
oh, yeah.
for that. In 2016, the Mets were kind of a big deal, right? Mm-hmm. So when you got the call, what was your reaction?
Oh, I was excited. I was actually the year before that rooting against the Mets because I was a Cubs fan
right
in the playoffs.
Yeah.
So, they beat my Cubs. And crazy how things change within a year. Now I'm a Met, huge Met fan, now have to be. And it was just unbelievable how fast things change. And it was awesome. I can't complain at all.
That you bring up an interesting topic because I don't think fans fully appreciate. You grow up a fan of one team, mm-hmm. and then just with a bolt of lightning, you got to drop your allegiance, get a whole new team, especially yep. when it's kind of a rival mm-hmm. team. I mean, I can't imagine you love Daniel Murphy, for example.
Yeah, and especially going out at home just like they eat, and everybody knows you're a Met now. You're kind of the enemy. Right. They don't know how to act and
right.
talk. But like a year ago, I was a fan of the Cubs as well, so it was just a weird situation. But I'm super happy to be a Met. It's been great ever since 2016. It still is great, and can't complain at all.
Heartland Community College in Normal, Illinois, mm-hmm. and to me, Normal's fascinating because it's like exactly on the dividing line between Cubs fans and Cardinals mm-hmm. fans, right? So were you one of those guys who had to, I'm not suggesting you got into fistfights or anything, but did you have to defend your Cubdom down there sometimes?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of Cardinals fans down there, and I think a lot more than Cubs or anything else around there. So I really had to defend my my Cub fandom for a while, and then right after that I kind of had to abandon it. It was kind of a weird situation, but it was fun down there, and there was definitely a lot of diehard Cardinals fans.
Yeah. What other sports did you follow? I mean, is it Chicago across the board? Bears fan, Hawks fan, the whole thing? Or
yes, I'm a Bears fan. I'm a Hawks fan. But college football, Ohio State fan.
My really?
I had a cousin that played there when I was younger, and we went to all the games. He played offensive line for them. He played in the NFL for a little bit. So I just was around Ohio State growing up, and I just became a diehard Ohio State fan.
Well, I would think you go to the Horseshoe once, you're probably hooked a little bit.
Oh, yes.
I went to Northwestern, so, I mean, it's mm-hmm. just it's not exactly the same experience.
Yeah.
I get it.
Mm-hmm.
Dyke Stadium is not exactly the same thing. So just talking about, again, downtime, because you had so much of it with Tommy John surgery. What were the things you got better at? Is it Call of Duty or what else?
I'm a big gamer, and it was definitely Call of Duty in that time. I had a lot of Fortnite. It's just a way for me to stay in contact with my friends, especially when I'm away. So that's been a big part of my life, especially in my professional career. But that's probably what I spent the most time with. And then being around my family, cause normally in the summer I'm nowhere to be found. I'm either with an affiliate or spring training or something, so it was nice to be home and enjoy a summer in Chicago.
So one quick baseball thing, which is a little offbeat, but we were talking earlier about you're a taller guy, taller pitcher, 6'7", and we look at Tyler McGill, for example, and mm-hmm. what he's doing with the Mets, and like you, drafted around that same swath of the draft, right? Mm-hmm. Do you look at guys like that, or if not Tyler, specifically, are there people in the majors where you say, okay, that guy's similar, I could be like that guy?
I think early in my career, I definitely did that a lot. I tried to always compare myself to someone in the big leagues. But I think as I've gotten older, I've kind of had to realize it's not about kind of trying to be someone else. I've really had to develop into my best version of myself.
Right.
And there's not, you know, there's no one else. There's not another Colin Holderman from, you know, Bourbon, Illinois. So I just have to really find out what, you know, is best for me and do that and not stray away from it at all.
Yeah, that's actually a great answer. And these answers, by the way, the fans will pick up on this very quickly, coming from a guy with a better voice than I've got, and I got paid to do this. So was that something, I mean, when your voice changed, did people say to you, hey, you could be in radio, or hey, you should be a singer?
Well, I did a little bit of like the theater as a kid, and I sang a little bit, like all the like the church like musicals and all that stuff.
Right.
But once I hit puberty, my voice, my singing voice kind of went away pretty fast. But they said I've heard a few things of maybe you should try no radio voice, but I definitely don't have the face for TV, so I'd have to be behind the radio or something. So maybe someday.
Well, you got a lot of pitching still to do. And so my question, I guess, just to keep it on baseball just for the couple more minutes we got together, St. Lucie and Binghamton this past year, do you put a timetable on anything? Like you're saying, okay, I've seen Binghamton, now I'm ready for Syracuse. And I mean, so do you put pressure on yourself to, I've got to climb the ladder?
I try not to, but I was fortunate enough, me and Brian McTwire were up in Syracuse for the last, you know, like week or two of the season throwing. We were supposed to throw some live BPs, just kind of get a feeling of how AAA is, be around the guys. And we were extremely fortunate for that because we got to see how, you know, they handled their business. And some, a lot of guys that have been in the big leagues, been back, and just kind of see how they go about their day, how they prepare. So I'm extremely confident that, you know, next year, wherever, you know, I am, if that's in, you know, Binghamton, Syracuse, that I'll be successful.
Yeah.
And I'm excited for it.
And there you go. And that's our show. From Hodges to Holderman, from the southern part of State Route 150 in America's heartland to that very same part of that very same road all the way up, we have woven these two men together. One hopefully part of the Mets' future, the other a huge and now Hall of Fame part of the Met story past. This is Josh Lewin. Hope we kept you busy for the last 20-odd minutes. Let's thank the Mets in the Morning House Band for all their hard work before we go. On keyboards, Joe Orsolak. Snapping to bass, Jake Marisnik. The horn section, let's go with Indiana native Kevin Plawecki. And on drums, just to pour one out here for Gil Hodges and congratulate him one more time, World Series MVP from 1969, Don Clendenin. I think that's a nice touch. This is Josh Lewin. Take it easy. Thanks so much. And seriously, big, big, big congratulations to Gil Hodges. So richly deserved.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.